Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from a double issue, September 11th and September 18th, 2020. So we'll get two readings out of this magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a red pickup truck going away from the viewer. In the back of the pickup truck are three men. There's a Trump 2020 flag and an American flag. One of the men is spraying a fire extinguisher out of the truck at somebody. One's firing paintballs, and the other one's just angrily pointing and screaming at somebody. With their back to us on the ground outside the truck are two other young men, one black, one white, with their fists in the air, and looks like they're screaming back at the folks in the truck. The title is Playing at Civil War. As extremists and vigilantes battle in the streets, how will it affect the election? And that's our first main story. We'll start right there. Violence roils the presidential campaigns. What happened? President Trump visited Kenosha, Wisconsin this week to press the law and order message that's become his chief reelection theme in the wake of a police shooting of a black man there and the ensuing fatal shooting of two protesters, allegedly by a 17-year-old Trump supporter. Trump met with law enforcement officials in the small lakeside city and toured buildings torched by rioters. The violence erupted after police responding to a call for help shot 29-year-old Jacob Blake seven times in the back as he tried to enter his car, severing his spine and leaving him paralyzed. Trump, who did not meet with Blake's family, blamed the violence on far-left politicians who push the destructive message that our nation and our law enforcement are oppressive or racist. Trump also defended Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old charged with killing two protesters and injuring a third last week with a military-style rifle. Rittenhouse, who's been charged with homicide, illegal weapons possession, and four other crimes, drove in from Illinois to join groups of vigilantes patrolling Kenosha's streets to defend the city from protesters. A video seems to show him shooting and killing a protester who threw a bag at him, and then being chased, falling, and shooting two other protesters trying to take his gun away. He has claimed self-defense. Trump said that Rittenhouse has been violently attacked and probably would have been killed. In Portland, Oregon, a caravan that included members of the far-right group Patriot Prayer drove through downtown Saturday, firing paintballs and pepper spray at police brutality protesters who've staged demonstrations around the federal courthouse for months. A 39-year-old supporter of Patriot Prayer was fatally shot by an unknown assailant during a confrontation on the street. In a tweet, Trump called the caravan members great patriots, defending Portland against disgraceful anarchists. In a speech, Democratic nominee Joe Biden fired back at Trump, blaming him for stoking division and recklessly encouraging violence. Biden said he unequivocally condemned the lawlessness in Kenosha and other cities, called for looters to be prosecuted, and challenged Trump's claims that disorder would grow if he were elected. "I'd be looking to lower the temperature in this country, not raise it," said Biden, who planned to visit Kenosha on Thursday after the week went to press. Does anyone believe there will be less violence in America if Donald Trump is reelected? What the editorial said. The Portland victim's blood is on Democrats' hands, said the Wall Street Journal. His shooting is what happens when political leaders fail to perform the most basic responsibility of government to protect innocent lives and property. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and Oregon Governor Kate Brown have hamstrung law enforcement while indulging rioters who've attacked police and burned buildings. Now Democrats are trying to make alleged vigilantism the story rather than the failure of progressive Democratic governance. Trump's exploitation of Kenosha's pain is the foulest act of his presidency, said the Madison, Wisconsin Capital Times. One man has been paralyzed, two others are dead, and a city has been shaken to its very core. And the nation's president came to Wisconsin not to promote unity, but to fan the flames and praise armed vigilantes as patriots. What the columnist said. Democrats have finally woken up to the disorder in American cities, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Until now, they've been content to perpetuate a narrative of courageous young people rising up against systemic racism. Now that they fear the violence and chaos will hurt Biden, they're acknowledging it's wrong, but they're blaming Trump. Sorry, but looting and fires have mostly occurred in cities run by Democrats. If they can't maintain basic order, it's on them. In case you've forgotten, Trump, not Biden, is president, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Biden has never supported violence of any sort, and this week forcefully condemned people who exploit legitimate protests to loot and set fire to buildings. Trump, on the other hand, has encouraged police brutality and refuses to condemn right-wing terrorists like Rittenhouse. He wants to foment violence for reasons aide Kellyanne Conway explained to Fox News. The more chaos and anarchy and vandalism and violence reigns, the better it is for the very clear choice on who's best on public safety and law and order. Democrats do have a problem, said Robert Trusinski in TheBulwark.com. Polls show public opinion is turning against the Black Lives Matter protests. Democratic leaders haven't pushed back against the anarchist and revolutionary wing of the protest movement that has hijacked the protests to set fires and loot stores. This is precisely the sort of thing that could tip the election back to Trump. This is a profoundly dangerous moment, said Jack Holmes in Esquire.com. How did we land here with armed militias and military cosplay patrolling the streets? Start with state legislatures that passed open carry laws. Now we have hundreds of militiamen supporting the president by carrying military-grade weapons on city streets. It's the culmination of a long-building national psychosis. And a second main story, Trump administration may rush vaccine. The U.S. surpassed 6 million confirmed COVID-19 cases and 185,000 deaths this week as new outbreaks erupted on college campuses and the virus moved further into rural areas. Some states are making progress against the disease. The country registered 34,000 new cases on Monday, the lowest single-day total in over 2 months, and coronavirus hospitalizations have dropped by 45% to 78% in California, Texas, Florida, and Arizona from their July peaks. But cases climbed in 32 states, particularly the Dakotas, Kansas, Minnesota, Nebraska, and Iowa, which, despite having the higher number of cases per capita, will allow 25,000 football fans to attend Iowa State's opening game next week. The start of college may be sparking new hotspots, with the University of Alabama reporting more than 1,300 COVID-19 cases since classes started in mid-August. The virus is like a rolling fire, said Amesh Adalia of Johns Hopkins University, with certain flare-ups that occur in different parts of the country. FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn said he was prepared to grant fast-track authorization for a COVID-19 vaccine as soon as October, even before mass clinical trials were complete, so long as the benefits of doing so outweigh the risks. Hahn said President Trump has not pressured him to approve a vaccine before the November 3rd election. Meanwhile, the Centers for Disease Control told state public health officials to prepare to distribute a vaccine to high-risk groups by November 1st. The CDC drew criticism from health professionals last week after it abruptly reversed its COVID-19 testing guidelines to say that people who had been in close contact with an infected person do not necessarily need a test if they show no symptoms. What the editorial said. Trump has a new pandemic advisor, said the Los Angeles Times, and he's offering some dangerous advice. Scott Atlas, a radiologist with no background in infectious diseases, was spotted by Trump on Fox News and is now helping steer White House policy. Atlas wants the U.S. to adopt Sweden's morally reprehensible herd immunity strategy. Never mind that letting 65% of the population get infected to reach herd immunity may result in millions of deaths. We hate to be the bearer of good news, said the Wall Street Journal, but the U.S. is doing well in the fight against the pandemic. Although cases are rising in the Midwest, the flare-ups so far are well below the spring Northeast debacle or the surge in the South and West. States are getting better at protecting the elderly, and treatments are improving. Our goal now should be to mitigate the virus damage while reopening businesses and schools, allowing Americans to return to some semblance of normalcy. What the columnist said. The CDC's new testing guidelines make no sense, said Faye Flam in Bloomberg.com. Some 40% of people infected with COVID-19 are asymptomatic, but they can still spread the disease to others. Rather than discouraging testing, the government should be advocating for mass testing so the small fraction of people who actually have an active infection can be quarantined while the rest of us regain our freedom. Discouraging testing only makes sense if your goal is to undercount cases. Who might that benefit? Multiple news outlets reported last week that the CDC changed its testing guidelines under pressure from the administration, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. But political interference won't stop the growing availability of fast, reliable COVID-19 tests. Abbott Labs has won approval for a test that costs $5, returns an answer in 15 minutes, requires no specialized equipment, and can be produced in bulk. You might soon be able to stop at a drive-through testing center, get a result in under half an hour, then arrive at a dinner party with a negative certificate in hand. As eager as Americans are for a vaccine, history shows why fast-tracking one could be catastrophic, said Jen Christensen in CNN.com. In 1955, the government gave the first polio vaccine to 200,000 children. 40,000 kids contracted polio, and some 10 died. An unsafe COVID-19 vaccine would light a fire under the anti-vaxxer movement. All it takes is one bad side effect to basically botch a vaccine program that we desperately need, said University of Michigan Professor Howard Markle. It's a prescription for disaster. Our controversy of the week is titled Republican Convention. Did Trump save his campaign? The media's storyline of the 2020 election was set. Joe Biden would win by emphasizing his niceness and letting President Trump get beaten by the pandemic. But then last week at the Republican convention, Trump tore up the media narrative and wrote a new script, said Daniel McCarthy in Spectator.org. Trump reintroduced himself as the only candidate willing to fight the left-wing mobs who've torched buildings and battled cops in Kenosha and Portland, Oregon. Speakers reminded voters of Trump's first-term accomplishments, tax cuts, regulatory reform, the defeat of ISIS, and testified to his rarely seen softer side. While Trump used his acceptance speech to lay out a powerful, simple case for his reelection, said Scott Jennings in the Los Angeles Times. Either voters entrust him with a second term, or they elect a Democratic president certain to raise taxes, stand aside for the rioters, and open a Pandora's box of bad liberal policy. From the often unfocused Trump, his pledge to restore law and order and the economy was very effective. Call it, Make America Normal Again. Most voters aren't stupid, said Robin Abkarian, also in the Los Angeles Times. Trump's shiny new message, vote for me because what's happening on my watch is unacceptable, doesn't actually make sense. And the rest of last week's spectacle was even less convincing. A dutiful parade of women and minorities tried to gaslight viewers that our race-baiting, misogynist president actually treats women with respect and is a champion of black Americans. It was both astonishing and nauseating to witness Trump's brazen hijacking of the White House as a backdrop to his authoritarian-themed coronation, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. By law, neither federal employees nor federal buildings can be used in political campaigns. Trump's gross misuse of public resources while delivering a fear-mongering speech about law and order as he flouted the law was a perfect finale to 4 days of repulsive and dishonest propaganda. The convention wasn't designed to please liberal pundits, said Mark Thiessen, also in the Washington Post. It was targeted at the reluctant voters, predominantly women in the suburbs, who supported Trump in 2016, but have been turned off by the media's insistence he's an angry racist. All Trump had to do last week was create a permission structure to let these right-leaning voters come home in November. This he did with typical showman's flair, pardoning a black woman jailed for a nonviolent drug crime and presiding over a naturalization ceremony for a diverse group of immigrants. Will it work? Who knows, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. But Trump's off-maligned campaign staffers clearly know what they're doing. Yes, they know they can't run on Trump's disastrous record or his divisive personality, said Jonathan Allen in NBCNews.com. So the convention offered a beguiling Fantasyland version of President Trump, a smart, compassionate, humble leader who has apparently defeated the coronavirus, saved the economy, and promoted racial harmony. But after 3 long years of alternative facts, polls show that crucial blocks of the electorate have grown tired of deceptions. Trump is running as a secessionist, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. He left no doubt, as he derisively condemned protests and looting in Democrat-run cities, that he regards himself as a wartime leader of red America against blue America. Whether voters are happy for that war to continue and escalate, with the risk that it might cease to be a metaphor, is the biggest question on the ballot this November. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for Jake and Elwood Blues, joint protagonist of 1980s comic cult movie The Blues Brother, which was this week endorsed by the Vatican newspaper as a Catholic classic. The film's muddled plot involves the brothers' mission from God, efforts to raise money for a Catholic orphanage where they grew up. It was a good week for the non-binary. After the new Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War video game will allow players to choose characters of any gender or no gender at all, or even to have their gender remain classified. And it was a good week for an alternative to the middle seat after the pilot of an American Airlines jet coming in to land at Los Angeles LAX Airport radioed the control tower to report that we just passed a guy in a jetpack at 3,000 feet. The guy has not yet been identified. But it was a bad week for Scots, the historical dialect of the Scottish people, after it emerged that nearly half of the Scots version of Wikipedia was written by a North Carolina teenager who faked the language. In one entry, he called himself a body that's mither tongue in the Scots. It was a bad week for staying on message after the Twitter accounts of the late Herman Cain tweeted that it looks like the coronavirus is not as deadly as the mainstream media first made it out to be. Cain died of COVID-19 in July after attending a Trump rally in Tulsa. Finally, it was a bad week for double standards after a maskless House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, had her hair washed and blow-dried inside an otherwise closed San Francisco hair salon, even though salons have not been cleared to reopen there. Pelosi's office said the speaker complied with the rules as presented to her by this establishment. Short news piece before we move on. DOJ limited Mueller's Russia investigation. Special Counsel Robert Mueller never investigated President Trump's possible ties to Russia or whether he was compromised by financial or sexual matters. A new book from the New York Times' Michael Schmidt reports. Schmidt quotes former Justice Department and FBI officials saying that former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein secretly ordered Mueller to confine his investigation to criminal matters arising from the 2016 Russian election interference. "I love Ken Starr," said Rosenstein, "but his investigation was a fishing expedition. Don't do that." Former FBI Director Andrew McCabe said Rosenstein never told him about the limits put on Mueller, and if he had known, he would have had the FBI do its own investigation of the national security threat. Since we are in one of our double issues, we'll read a few of the short news pieces from the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance, starting with the U.S. California, fire deaths. Firefighters continue to advance on a series of historic wildfires that have already left 8 dead and scorched nearly 1.5 million acres. Among the dead is Diana Jones, a 63-year-old grandmother from Crescent, Texas, who traveled with several members of her hometown volunteer fire department to assist beleaguered California authorities. She died in a motor vehicle accident while helping to fight a sprawling batch of fires known as the August Complex, which has burned 242,000 acres in the Mendocino National Forest, about 150 miles north of San Francisco. The state has witnessed 900-plus fires since August 15th, many of them ignited by a sustained barrage of more than 14,000 lightning strikes. State fire officials said they had brought the two largest blazes, the so-called SCU and LNU lightning complex fires, under at least 66% control, but still expected a final tally of 3,000 structures destroyed. Louisiana, after Laura. Hurricane Laura cut a swath of destruction and misery across the southwestern part of the state last week, tearing apart whole neighborhoods and killing 14 people with historic 150-mile-per-hour winds. The Category 4 storm made landfall in the early morning hours on Thursday near Cameron, whipping up storm surges to approximately 11 feet. It toppled trees onto homes, rendered 82 local water systems inoperable, and left few areas untouched, although it largely spared southeastern Texas. In the days before its arrival, about 500,000 people evacuated, many with the memory of 2005's Hurricane Rita in mind. This week, they returned with fingers crossed to survey the damage. "We are picking up the pieces," said Mayor Nick Hunter of Lake Charles. "It's going to be quite a task." Richmond, Virginia. Trans rights victory. A federal appeals court ruled this week that a transgender former high school student who identifies as male should not have been denied access to the men's bathroom before his graduation 3 years ago. Gavin Grimm, now 21, said he continued with the suit he filed in 2015 as a sophomore against the Gloucester County School Board because he wanted others to have what I was denied, the opportunity to be seen for who we are by our schools and our government. The district argued that it had provided Grimm a single-stall alternative and called him by his new name and male pronouns, but that teachers and students should not have to share a restroom with someone from the opposite physiological sex. The 2-1 ruling from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit turned on the Supreme Court's June decision to extend sex-based discrimination protection to trans workers. In the world at a glance, this is from Banff, Alberta. Americans stay out. Canada is cracking down on Americans who sneak across the border to take in the beauty of Banff National Park. Because of the pandemic, Americans are allowed to cross the border only to drive between Alaska and the lower 48 states, and they may not stop at any hotels or parks along the way. Kentucky resident John Pennington was seen at a hotel in Banff in June, issued a $900 ticket, and ordered to remain in his room until he departed the next day. But the next afternoon, police spotted his car at a local tourist attraction, and he was arrested. Canadian authorities announced last week that Pennington, who was escorted out of the country, could face a fine of up to $569,000 or 6 months in jail. Rio de Janeiro. COVID corruption. A Brazilian court has suspended the governor of Rio State as part of an investigation into the alleged misuse of coronavirus relief funds. Prosecutors say Governor Wilson Witzel is at the top of the pyramid of a scheme of bribes and kickbacks to get the state coronavirus monies. They say Witzel created a criminal organization within the state government that directed state contracts to build extra hospitals, for example, to businesses run by his cronies. Groups that sought bids had to pay into a bribery box. Witzel, a former judge who came to power on anti-corruption platform, denied all charges and said they were orchestrated by his former ally-turned-rival, President Jair Bolsonaro, whom he has accused of corruption. Witzel is best known for his harsh military-style crackdown on gangs in Rio de Janeiro's favelas. Derek, Syria. Russian aggression. U.S. forces were harassed by the Russian military at least four times over the past week. In northeastern Syria, a Russian armored vehicle deliberately rammed an American military vehicle, leaving seven U.S. service members with concussions. Days later, Russian jets veered in front of a U.S. B-52 bomber over the Black Sea. Meanwhile, over the Baltic Sea, two Russian warplanes shadowed another B-52 well into Danish airspace. Six Russian military planes also loitered for hours just off the coast of Alaska, forcing the Air Force to scramble F-22s to intercept them. Analysts say Russia has been emboldened by the lack of condemnation from the Trump administration. "We have not imposed serious consequences to prevent ongoing escalation," said Russia expert Alina Polyakova. New Delhi, double crisis. India is now grappling with one of the world's worst economic downturns and one of the fastest-growing COVID-19 outbreaks. The Indian economy shrank by 24% last quarter, probably by much more if laborers, farmhands, and others who work off the books are taken into account. And the country added 500,000 new coronavirus infections in just the past week, bringing its total caseload to nearly 4 million. Both crises can be traced to Prime Minister Narendra Modi's decision in March to declare a three-week lockdown with no warning. Millions of migrant workers were stranded in cities with no income, and they packed the last trains out of town and headed to their home villages. The exodus spread the virus and upended the economic system, which relies on cheap labor in the cities. Hong Kong. Escape thwarted. A dozen Hong Kong pro-democracy activists who tried to escape to Taiwan in a speedboat last week were arrested by Chinese authorities some 50 miles offshore. Among those captured was Andy Lee, a 30-year-old activist who helped organize a global parliamentary alliance with members in 16 national legislatures and the European Parliament to assist the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong. He was arrested early in August under the city's new Beijing-imposed national security law for collaborating with foreign forces. His lawyers had told him he would certainly be convicted and spend decades in prison in gulag-style conditions on the Chinese mainland. Since last fall, activists fleeing Hong Kong have been attempting to boat the 450 miles to Taiwan. Those who complete the journey are quietly allowed in. Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Migrants tortured. Saudi Arabia is keeping hundreds of African migrants locked in hellish conditions as part of its campaign to slow the spread of COVID-19. And only those who can pay bribes are released and deported. Cell phone photos sent to British media show dozens of emaciated men lying shirtless, tightly packed together in cells with barred windows. Migrants who managed to communicate to reporters through WhatsApp said they were being beaten and starved. "We are packed like animals. We sleep on metal beds with no mattress, no proper sanitation," Ibrahim, a Somali, told The Guardian. "We drink water from the toilet." Saudi Arabia relies on cheap African labor, but 2 years ago it began cracking down on undocumented workers and warehousing them in massive prison in Jeddah that can accommodate 32,000 inmates. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Pompeo's shameful legacy. "Mike Pompeo is the worst Secretary of State in history," said Jackson Deal. "He and his boss, President Trump, have left U.S. foreign policy in shambles. Pompeo has presided over the collapse of negotiations with North Korea, the failure of a pressure campaign against Iran, and an abortive attempt to oust Venezuela's authoritarian regime. He's failed to make China pay any price for its genocide of the Uyghurs and is crushing of Hong Kong's freedoms. Morale at the State Department is at historic low, as Pompeo has purged hundreds of career diplomats, ordered staffers to carry out errands for himself and his wife, and fired the inspector general who is investigating his many ethical violations. Last week, Pompeo, eyeing a 2024 presidential run, flouted the State Department's explicit guidance against political activity by addressing the Republican convention from Jerusalem, falsely claiming major achievements. To see how much diplomatic damage Pompeo has done, consider his recent attempt to arm twist the U.S.'s European allies into extending an arms embargo on Iran and reimposing U.N. sanctions. He lost by a humiliatingly lopsided vote. The U.S. now stands visibly isolated in the world. That is Pompeo's true legacy. The latest cancel culture victim. "The father of the national parks has been canceled," said John Fund. "Who's next?" John Muir has long been an iconic hero to environmentalists, but the Sierra Club has announced it is severing any association with its founder, because as a young immigrant from Scotland in the 19th century, Muir made derogatory comments about black people and indigenous peoples. The fact that Muir's views evolved later in his life, the Sierra Club said, cannot salvage his tarnished reputation, even though he wrote admiringly of Native American tribes after he went to live among them. If we are to expunge from their place of honor all the historical figures who changed their views later in life, or who held views that were common in their time, where will it stop? Martin Luther King Jr. once counseled a black teen who confessed his attraction to boys to seek a good psychiatrist to overcome this problem. John F. Kennedy threatened to send a Democratic donor who wanted to be an ambassador to one of those boogie republics in Central Africa. His brother Robert Kennedy wiretapped King. By cancel culture standards, aren't these irredeemable sins? Which soon-to-be tarnished icon will be next? This is from Ireland. Not a time to party in secret. They're calling it Golfgate, said Pat Leahy. 2 weeks ago, dozens of members of Ireland's political elite flouted coronavirus restrictions that they themselves had enacted to attend a 50th anniversary tournament and gala dinner for the legislature's golf society. The indoor sit-down dinner took place at a posh hotel in County Galway, which is under such a strict lockdown that grieving Irish families have had to miss their relatives' funerals. That's why the revelation of the gathering has led to a welter of sackings and resignations, claiming the careers of several senators, a cabinet minister, and a European commissioner. Politicians say they have seldom, if ever, seen such immediate and palpable public anger. That government officials have lost their jobs was perhaps inevitable. What's shocking, though, is that Ireland's most powerful European official, Trade Commissioner Phil Hogan, who was also forced out, a blow to Irish influence in Brussels at a time when ongoing Brexit negotiations with Britain are so crucial to our economy. Hogan could likely have saved himself with a sincere show of contrition, but his apology was deemed insufficiently full-throated. Let this scandal be a lesson to all public figures. There is no hiding anywhere from the constant gaze of social media, and when judgment comes, it can be savage. This is from Canada. Why we won't go Trumpist. Ever since Donald Trump was elected next door, said Peter DiNolo, Canada's progressives have been living in fear that Trumpism will jump the border and infect the Canadian body politic. They can relax. Canada will never go Trumpist, not because we're too noble, but because our population is simply too small to bankroll the carnivalesque galaxy of profiteers needed to power a Trump-style right wing. The U.S. veered off the course of good governance back in 1987 when it eliminated the fairness doctrine that required the airing of contrasting views on political issues. That misguided reform birthed right-wing radio and TV, creating stars like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, who spew an endless stream of propaganda. That massive politico-entertainment complex was more about money than politics. Canada can't generate such profits because our market isn't big enough to support far-right TV. The sunk costs for such an enterprise are huge. Just look at our one attempt to copy Fox, the Sun News Network launched in 2011. It drew just 8,000 viewers at any given time and folded after 3 years, having lost an impressive $35 million. Our few right-wing stars don't preach to Canadians, but to the U.S. right-wing ecosystem, where the real money is. We have two obituaries for you this week, starting with the Black Panther star who portrayed African-American icons, Chadwick Boseman, 1976 to 2020. Chadwick Boseman soared to cinematic stardom by playing a series of heroic black figures, and in the process became something of one himself. The actor's breakout came in 2013 with 42, in which Boseman portrays a young Jackie Robinson as he shatters baseball's color line. He followed it up by playing two more African-American trailblazers, soul singer James Brown in Get On Up, 2014, and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall in Marshall, 2017. But it was Marvel's Black Panther, 2018, that made Boseman a superstar. As T'Challa, king of the fictional African country, Wakanda, Boseman heads a hyper-advanced civilization that has avoided colonial incursion. When his nation is threatened, box office juggernaut and cultural phenomenon, T'Challa transforms into the superhero warrior Black Panther. A box office juggernaut and a cultural phenomenon, Black Panther exploded the Hollywood myth that black-led mainstream movies can't be global smashes. I hope people will watch this movie and see a hero in themselves, said Boseman, who died of colon cancer last week at age 43. Even if it's a white person who sees it, if they can see a black character and identify with them, it changes a little bit of how our society is. Boseman was born in Anderson, South Carolina, to a nurse mother and a father who worked in a textile factory and had an upholstery business on the side, said the Times. A quiet child with a passion for drawing and hopes of being an architect, he later recalled how racism was a fact of life growing up. I've been called nigger, he said, and run off the road by a redneck. When a fellow member of his high school basketball team was shot and killed, Boseman turned to playwriting to express his pain. He enrolled at Howard University with the dream of becoming a director, said the New York Times, but an acting class shifted his focus. After graduating, he moved to New York to work in theater, writing and directing several plays. He landed various small TV parts, then a recurring role as a haunted Iraq War veteran in the ABC series, Lincoln Heights. When Boseman was plucked from relative obscurity to star in 42, his unfussy versatility and old-fashioned gravitas helped turn him into one of his generation's most sought-after leading men. To prepare for Black Panther, Boseman took research trips to South Africa, traced his own ancestry, and studied African martial arts and Maasai warriors, said The Guardian. Deeply committed to the film's message of black empowerment, he was well aware his role represented something more than just the escapades of a cinematic superhero, said The Washington Post. And it was a source of deep satisfaction that the movie became a symbol of pride for many black moviegoers. None of them knew Boseman had been diagnosed with colon cancer in 2016, something he kept secret from co-stars even while filming Spike Lee's Vietnam War epic, The Five Bloods, released this spring, and his final role in a film version of August Wilson's play, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. His guiding ambition, he said in 2018, was for viewers to see black people in ways which you have not seen them before. The Georgetown coach who put his players first. John Thompson, Jr., 1941 to 2020. As head coach of Georgetown University's men's basketball team from 1972 to 1999, John Thompson, Jr. transformed the Hoyas into a national powerhouse, known for his unrelenting defense and toughness that mirrored his own personality. Anchored by future NBA Hall of Fame centers Patrick Ewing, Alonzo Mourning, and Dikembe Mutombo, Thompson's predominantly black squads broke down racial barriers in Washington, D.C., and turned blue and gray starter jackets and Nike sneakers into cultural touchstones. The coach bristled when sports reporters called him a racial pioneer for his achievements, rejecting the label even after his greatest victory, when his team beat Houston in the 1984 NCAA final. Thompson was asked how it felt to be the first black coach to win it all. "I'm not interested in being the first or only black doing anything," he replied. It implied that in 1984, a black man finally became intelligent enough to win an NCAA title. That's a very misleading thing. Born in Washington, Thompson was enrolled in Catholic school by his house cleaner mother, who believed he would benefit from the academic rigor, said the Washington Post. Unusually tall for his age, he would grow to 6'10". He became a basketball star at Archbishop Carroll High. But Washington was a segregated city for much of his youth, and at church, Thompson had to wait for white parishioners to finish their prayers before he could approach the altar. He continued his education at Providence College, leading the Friars in 1964 to their first NCAA tournament. Drafted by the Boston Celtics, he spent two seasons backing up Bill Russell before retiring. After 7 years as a high school coach, said the Associated Press, Thompson took over the moribund Georgetown program, winner of only three games the previous season. Georgetown's teams had been mostly white, but that changed quickly under Thompson, said ESPN.com. As a term of his hiring, he asked for permission to recruit players who didn't meet Georgetown's rigorous admission standards. To ensure his players had a chance at educational success, he also negotiated the hiring of a former nun as the Hoyas' academic coordinator. Of the 78 players who played four seasons under Thompson, said the New York Times, 76 received their degrees. The most famous was Ewing, who powered Georgetown to the 84 title over Houston. During a 1983 game against Providence, Thompson spotted a sign in the stands that said, "Ewing can't read." He pulled his players until it was removed. More controversially, Thompson boycotted two games in 1989 to protest the NCAA's decision to scrap financial aid for recruits who didn't meet stringent academic standards, said the Ringer.com. He viewed the rule as racially biased and classist, and it was amended. Thompson retired in 1999, having compiled a career record of 596 wins to 239 losses. Big John remained a campus mainstay, offering players profanity-laced advice. A deflated basketball in his office symbolized his motto for student athletes: "Don't let 8 pounds of air be the sum total of your existence." Here are a couple of business columns for you. The California way of killing business. For a sneak peek at a Biden presidency, just head to California, said Andy Kessler. Democrats have controlled the state assembly since 1997 and the governorship since 2011. As a result, we're number one in top marginal income tax rate at 13.3%. and number one in state sales tax. This month, Californians have been subjected to rolling blackouts because of the state's renewable energy mandates, since solar cells become worthless when the sun goes down every evening. The state then has to buy energy on the market at exorbitant cost. We're number three in water prices, hurting the farmers who grow 90% of America's broccoli, 95% of its garlic, and two-thirds of fruits and nuts. Now ask why your prices are going up. Then there's Assembly Bill 5, the law that state passed to smother the gig economy. What do the 300,000 Uber drivers and 200,000 Lyft drivers actually want, as opposed to what California says they want? Doesn't matter. The U.S. House of Representatives is already threatening to take some of those policies national. So this craziness could be yours too. Before remote work made it possible to live anywhere, this state was blessed with tax dollars from employees of Apple, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Palantir. Oops, check that. Palantir is moving to Colorado. Can't say I blame them. Looking for an office chaplain? The corporate clergy has arrived to bring order to our chaotic working environment, said Nellie Bowles. With work taking up ever more of our day, Americans are eager to find ways to soften cruel capitalism, making space for the soul. Some theologians see a calling and an opportunity. We've seen brands enter the political space, says one of the Harvard Divinity-trained founders of the spiritual consultancy Sacred Design Lab. The next white space in advertising and brands is spirituality. Eager to help their employees find meaning in the workplace, some CEOs are seeking out this kind of advice. The co-founder of Pinterest hired Sacred Design Lab to categorize all major religious practices and think of ways to apply them to the office. They made him a spreadsheet. The new spiritual advisors have found ways to repurpose the rituals of religion to create new ones for the office, though perhaps not exactly ones that traditional spiritual leaders anticipated. The consultancy ritualist comes up with events for work-life situations, such as celebrations for a project success or funerals to help people process the grief when a project fails. Still, the spiritual and corporate don't always sit comfortably together. As Sacred Design Lab's Angie Thurston puts it, how can we be in deep community if I can fire you? And we'll just turn the page and finish out on the business news page today. Start with Tesla cashing in on a stock price run-up. Tesla's stratospheric rise in share price continued this week after the company executed its first ever stock split, said Dave Sebastian in the Wall Street Journal. The electric car maker is now seeking to cash in on its good fortune by selling $5 billion in new stock. The 5-for-1 split, which came on the same day that Apple executed a 4-for-1 split of its own surging stock, only encouraged more investors to pile into the pricey yet popular stock, which has soared a striking 479% this year. Trading activity on the day of the splits was so intense that it crashed online trading platforms Robinhood and TD Ameritrade. CEO Elon Musk has learned how to strike when the iron is hot, says Ann Schraders in Fortune.com. While the question of whether Tesla deserves its sky-high valuation is increasingly at the fore, the new stock sale is giving Tesla bulls plenty of breathing room. The company has sustained profitability even during the pandemic, and the stock sale means that Tesla, still $8.6 billion in debt, is in no danger of running out of money, undermining the lingering bear thesis of Tesla skeptics. The 1-2 punch of the stock split and capital raise also all but guarantees Tesla's inclusion in the S&P 500. Bias. Black franchise owners sue McDonald's. About 50 former franchise owners sued McDonald's this week, claiming the fast food chain discriminated against them, said Alistair Gray in the Financial Times. The franchisees say McDonald's routinely steered black franchisees into depressed neighborhoods with low sales volumes and high cost, and that they were subject to harsher inspection standards. The number of black McDonald's franchise owners has dropped by more than half since 1998, while the number of franchise restaurants has more than doubled. Airlines, goodbye to hefty change fees. The three biggest airlines eliminated the $200 change fee on domestic tickets, said Chris Isidore in CNN.com. United Airlines, which had already waived fees through the end of this year, was the first to announce a permanent change last week, saying that they were ditching the reviled policy for good. Delta and American quickly followed suit. The decision cuts a major revenue source for the airlines, who netted $2.8 billion industry-wide from change fees in 2019. But airlines hope more flexibility attracts passengers after a modest recovery in air travel at the start of the summer started stalling out in July. A surge in home renovations and do-it-yourself projects during the pandemic has driven lumber prices up 134% year over year. That adds around $14,000 to the cost of building a new home, according to the National Association of Home Builders. Manufacturers of durable goods orders rose 11.2% in July, far outpacing the economists' expectations. The boom came largely from orders of new cars and trucks, jumping 22% after a nearly 24% gain the previous month. Well, with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.